that is Kiss from Prince and the Revolution. I basically am listening to the B-sides. This past week has been one full of remembrances and history making. And the recap of the week is coming to you from Tennessee Froward's Reading. Hi, y'all. Welcome to a cloudy Sunday morning as I celebrate the life and music of his royal purpleness, Prince. I'll be sprinkling in little sound bites from some of his most illustrious cuts as I talk about the nonsense coming from the GOP and just politics in general. Chauvin is guilty, and what does that mean for the rest of us? And just also, why have my handle as Tennessee Fro and I don't celebrate anything about Tennessee? Why look to the outside when there's some cool stuff happening here? Also, some weird crap is also happening. You know, we do get some stuff wrong, but we also get to do a lot of great things. And I hope you will see that as I see it. And I'll call it as I call it. And I hope you will enjoy this episode of Tennessee Froward's Reading. And I hope you guys have a blessed and just a cool Sunday day. Now, for more Prince. Be that long since DMX passed away at the age of 50 after cardiac arrest induced by a narcotic ingestion. Or a black prince. I'm also talking about Prince, 5 years dead this past week. And this is Party Up from the Best of DMX. And why not introduce this next segment about the tripping of politicians? Because this is the song that will make you think you're going crazy dealing with these fools. But that couldn't have been the issue. Or maybe they just see you now because they miss you. Shit, a nigga tried to diss you. That's why you laying on your back looking at the roof of the church. Preacher telling the truth and it hurts. Y'all gonna make me lose my mind. Up in here, up in here. Y'all gonna make me go all out. Up in here. I think this part of the podcast is probably going to be one of mine. I don't know my most favorite part because I call myself Tennessee Fro or Ten Fro, and I realized that stuff that I was interested in, it was always outside of the state. But I have a feeling that I missed the point of the name. Why can't I highlight things interesting that would interest me within my continued quarantine state? So, you know, even just across the South, we get a whole bunch of crap wrong, and a lot of things that we do are just stupid. Case in point, all this crap, the GOP, and they want it both ways. You want to pretend to be about the people, but the people that you represent are the top 5%, and none of them look like my ass. So we see you and we think you're tripping about the war on the trans kids and the LGBTQ community. We see you allowing the murder of so many trans women across the country, definitely in the South. And we see that and nobody's saying anything. I need y'all to stay the hell out of our Eucharists or uteruses for the non-ebonically said. We see you doing this voter suppression crap because we know you don't want us to be a part of the citizens. And you're trying to call safety to the voting process that's probably the safest in the world, because now if we keep the Russians out of our business, and there was no evidence
at all about widespread fraud, but y'all are still floating that narrative that the race was stolen, even though you know it's not, it wasn't stolen. So all you're trying to do, and it's very obvious, y'all going to try to flip the rules again to keep people, again, that look like me, away from voting. And also, I can also give big ups to the number one dopest Republicans, John Boehner. His first line in his introduction of his new book, "I walked out of the Capitol the same jackass I was when I walked in 25 years ago." That's how he starts his book. He reads not only the Republicans of his own party and the wackadoodles like Marjorie Greene and jackass Ted Kennedy, but he goes on to read the fractured Democratic Party too. It's a great read. And there's a lot of Bonnerisms in there that I think all of us, as well as both parties, should take note of, because I don't think it was his intent to give us a way back to sanity, but he very clearly recognized what the insanity is. And we can just start there. There's a great amount of things that need to be fixed. And he gives mad respect to Nancy Pelosi. He only had support for his junior congressman, now the House Minority Leader, McCarthy. But I think it's also very obvious that these polarizing nincompoops like Marjorie Greene and this aggressive, ultra-conservative base, don't get me wrong, this fool is very conservative and all about fiscal responsibility and you coming up by your bootstraps, but I don't think he is with this this disagreeable, say whatever gets the most clicks nonsense that's going on now. He understands that the only way forward is by us working together, and polarizing the party for some ill-conceived power trip is not how we're going to get there. And I say all of that to say the GOP, the South is clearly red with the exception of highlights of blue like in Hamilton County, Nashville, Memphis, and definitely surrounding the larger metropolitan cities in Georgia. And that's a power of what gives its flavor. But they need to stop it because there's just some dumb crap that they're doing in the South that does not make a whole bunch of sense to me. Welcome to America, pre-released from His Royal Badness, Prince. This album will be released July of this year, title of the same, Welcome to America. I saw this release on the news probably now 2 weeks ago, shocked that he was releasing still new music. And I had, as anyone, I had heard that Prince had a song or like a library of music that he could release full albums way into the next millennium. And now I think it's true. because prior to him dying, the producer of this album had said, why don't we release it now? And he said it wasn't the right time, and it wasn't the right time. But of course it's the right time, with all of the racial and racial injustice and reckoning that's happened since Breonna Taylor has been shot and the George Floyd trial. This, he was, as everyone that loves Prince knows, he was a beyond his time. How could he have written this song and forecast this time and where we are right now in America? It's apropos. I would suggest listening to it into its entirety on iTunes. You can just navigate to my podcast list. This is one of the songs that's included in this podcast that you can actually listen to in my Publish One podcast playlist. Now on to Guilty on All Three and my thoughts on this, also on this trial for this past week.
Truth is a new minority. Welcome to
me. I admit freely, I could not and would not watch the shaven ex-cop that killed George Floyd. I couldn't. And here's why. I make no excuses that the whole episode is triggering, and I was very annoyed that they still continue to play which is essentially a snuff film on TV. I get it. I can't imagine being a juror. I can't imagine being the prosecutor. I can't imagine being family members sitting in on that trial and having to, I couldn't wrap my mind around, how can you defend someone that's so indefensible? I realized there were 45 different people, a lot of them on the prosecution, that presented the case. I also realized the kid that actually initially recorded that murder was only probably not quite 17, 18 at the time. And there was she was with her 9-year-old cousin. All of these people bore witness to a murder. And it was different than the Rodney King VHS taping. This was real time. This guy, with no remorse, it was like there were no humans there at all. It seems like his intent was for control by any means. That was it. And so all of the children and how they just didn't, none of them didn't care. And I knew it could have been a slam dunk, but really it isn't. Because we know in places where it's not a slam dunk. It was a slam dunk because everybody from the prosecution, from the state attorney general to the prosecution, was very clear in that this was a murder and you can't, and we're not going to drop the ball. That was the thing. From the beginning, there it was clear. The prosecution was on a mission, how to present the best case possible that there could be no questions. But in cases like Tamir Rice, in cases like the big guy that also was selling cigarettes in New York, the young man that got capped by the East St. Louis police, it's not a slam dunk. You can be on tape. They can still. You can be Micaiah Bryant, who was shot by the Columbus police. Again, What is the rule of the hood? Don't bring a gun to a knife fight. These fools not only bought a gun to a knife fight, cops, they actually did some dumb shit, having Blue Lives Matter and screaming it out to mourning people. You know, I think it's absolutely disgusting. I think that we're still adding names to just being black. Well, it's an automatic death sentence in this country. And I get it. The news, you can't, it's not news if it doesn't get anybody watching. And yes, they're paying attention to these snuff films, these lynchings. But, and I take issue with people say, well, why don't they just not struggle? Well, if you know that people are coming after you to kill you, you basically are not in control of your feelings. But then you say, oh, I got to struggle. And then you say, oh, but they're the police. But I can't trust the police, so I'm going to struggle because I know it's probably going to end badly anyways. And I'd rather go down fighting than actually on my back. But when and it's stacked up against you over and over again. The disgusting part of it all is that none of them deserved death. I can truly say that. I also am just horrified of the black teenager that was killed also in Knoxville last week too. They got called. He was evidently in a domestic violence. He was 17. Domestic violence situation with his white girlfriend. But he beat that girl to heck, pulled out her hair. The mother, probably rightfully so, called the cops. They rolled on him, up on him at the school. Dude, he was armed. He actually had, if you believe what they say, had his hand on his gun. There was an accidental misfire, and they capped that kid. They went to handcuff him, but I keep asking this question. So y'all went to handcuff him, but his hand was still in the left part of his sweatshirt. But y'all didn't know he had a gun. What if his hands were up and y'all do the thing work to cuff him? That's how it should have been. Why was his hand still in his sweatshirt? And why did the dude also bring a gun to school? Was he intending to hurt that girl or to shoot up the school? But why did y'all, in what they say is put your hands up and up or behind your head and get on your knees and then you cuff him? He should. What was wrong with that? What was going on there? And this just happened in Tennessee, probably one of the most liberal gun states that just passed a permitless carry for 21 and older, but the 17-year-old still came into school with a 9. So I don't get that. I don't understand any of this. And for it to just go justified, there's so many parts of that that make absolutely no sense. I want to see the body cam because him actually being able to accidentally fire off and have his hand in his pocket while they're cuffing him. Do y'all realize that makes absolutely no sense to me at all? Y'all gonna have to take me through. I'm gonna need to see an unedited body cam video because we're missing something. And why isn't nobody talking about it? That's what's tripping me out. But then again, don't watch the news just because of this to go on. But that's neither here nor there. The lack of humanity, getting back to shaving and all these other killings, the lack of humanity and how easily this could have been potched because it wasn't a slam dunk. When the prosecution basically said, you can actually believe your eyes because there's nothing to question here. They basically were able and allowed to present a fair case because they had the unedited video of the 18-year-old kid that is also was going to be forever be traumatized because none of the witnesses could actually do anything about this. You know, and I also say that it probably wouldn't have been like this way because they probably would have had some type of editing and it probably could have been all discredited. But the defense is thing that he actually had 90% blockage. He was a drug abuser. He had hypertension. But they say the stress of the day was one of the and the stress of the day was what contributed. But he had all these underlying. Nah, bro. He could have survived the stress of the day if dude didn't have his knee on his neck for 10 minutes. You know, he may have lived longer if he didn't have those underlying. But the inciting event was a knee on the neck and three other big ass dudes, cops on his back because he couldn't take a breath. Essentially, they hung him. They smothered him. Stop it. But it could have went left really rapidly. And granted, did we need, I love Maxine Waters. I actually had the pleasure of meeting her 2 years ago while I was at the Renaissance Hotel for a Dallas Cowboy, the last Dallas Cowboy Redskins team formerly known as the Deadskins game back in September of 2019. And she actually, there was a Black Caucus was that same weekend. And she actually came through and she watched the game with us. I highly respect her and Congressman John Lewis are the last of the civil rights activists to be in Congress at this time. And she's the last of those stalwart. She gets the respect as any queen should. She was basically saying if they don't come with the right verdict that we should be aggressive and we should be getting angry. We should get aggressive. But them actually having a gas nozzle with mob violence in Minnesota coming out of her mouth and her wig cried a cricket. It's kind of funny because that's how she actually is. But she gets a bye because all of us know if they had come back with a hung jury or even a not guilty, it would have been wrong. And that is not justice. We have the unedited tape. That man killed him. And for him not to get any felony would have not made any sense to any of us. And it just would have made it increase that. Because we all Black people already thought it. If he gets away like they did the four for Rodney King when they had that video, I don't understand how they got off with that. But they did. They walked. They all got acquitted. I get the maybe she shouldn't have said it. But I can understand. That's a whole Chris Rock thing. It is different than inciting violence of no evidence of a stolen Alexa. Y'all let that fool talk shit for 4 years and finally wasn't banned from Twitter or Facebook, even Pinterest of all places, until he was out of the White House. He incited. They ran up on y'all in the White House. Put the stinky feet up on the Speaker of the House's desk, peed in the halls, broke windows. They did all of that stuff, ransacked the White House. My tax dollar paid for that. But when she says this, when it would be an obvious injustice, the bottom line is, don't say shit that's going to incite a riot. But who would have been more justified if the verdict came back in the wrong way? It would have made sense. he was basically just inciting a riot just for cred and just to prove that he could say whatever he wants to and he's going to activate the crazies. There was no rhyme or reason for why he was saying that, because there was no proof. This would have been a complete proof of white supremacy on display. Do I think she should have said it? No, but I can understand why she said it. As another middle-aged African-American woman who does not feel completely safe in this country. Because, and this is why, this is great for the people in Minnesota, but we know that justice is not equal in anywhere. It doesn't still change the fact that Minnesota is more, even more segregated than Chattanooga or any other city in the South, even though they pop off. And if they say it's great if you're white, but it's fucked up if you're black. And that's why it doesn't mean a whole bunch for people like me, because of retaliation. And I basically had mentioned this. I said, you know why they read that verdict? I got my friends and everybody was texting me that we're still all going to lay low because we know about retaliation. Case in point, the young lady that got shot in the chest in Ohio, and they basically yelling out Makia Bryant, and they basically saying Blue Lives Matter. We all know that in the South, because of what's happening in Minnesota, they basically are going straight up Jim Crow and everywhere else. Don't think we're going to be able to change anything and do anything like they are in Minnesota, because it means absolutely nothing to the rest of us, because it's still unequal until everybody gets on board. And everybody would have prosecuted a state. You can actually guarantee that the prosecutor would have prosecuted the case in anywhere else in this country and would have had the same results with even better evidence. So, do I think it's like actually a great thing for Minnesota? Yes, I do. But do I think things are going to change for the rest of us? No, I don't. Until we all get on the same page and also speak about the need for change in a national quorum and a discussion with actionable words that are going to help us get to a better place, to get that back to trust as well as to safety. I don't think the police reform doesn't mean that you get rid of police. I don't think that. But what I do think is it is obvious that your training methods suck, and we're none of us are safe until y'all improve it. Case in point, policemen are not, they're not babysitters and they're not psychiatrists. If there's an issue with domestic violence and there's an issue with a psychiatric problem, don't freaking send in a police that are not specifically trained for that. That's what a task force would actually get. What is actually should be in the public safety or the police domain, and what does additional training and specialty training look like to handle these types of situations? They got SVU, Special Victims Unit. They got drug task force. There actually needs to be a possibility of a behavioral health and a family domestic violence kind of situation. But I don't think the police are trained the way the training is now, where it's complete enforcement and correction and not necessarily de-escalation and mitigation, and then pass it on to the specialists that actually do that for a living. Don't send in a gun to a knife fight. And every time you dispatch a policeman into these situations where they're ill-prepared to handle, you're going to get nonsense. And also, until you take racist biases, microaggressions, and a kind of other suppositions out of training and out of society, you're never going to gain full trust of non-white and brown people or others to believe in anyone on the police force. And I'm just saying that. And I'm not saying that to be funny. I'm saying that to be factual. So it was great that this fool was actually found guilty of something that he was obviously guilty of. But the work has just begun on public safety reform, and racism, this ongoing discussion of racism in this country.
I did my best just to fit in. Broke my heart on the playground. When they said I was different.
That's Mickey Guyton from her EP Bridges, Black Like Me. She actually made history this past week hosting the CMAs with, what is his name? Keith Urban, I believe it was. There are several African-American and African-American female country artists that have made major contributions to the genre, and it's still, even in 2021, we're still first. I wanted to highlight her as this section of Black excellence, because I wanted you to listen to these words. And if I'm celebrating Black excellence, why haven't one of the great African-American artists reflecting music, and this song is apropos, Black Like Me. We're still doing great things, making contributions, and finally getting the recognition. It's just taking 2 centuries, but I'll take it. Mickey Guyton, Black Like Me.
So today in Black elegance, I should say, and everything Tennessee cool, I have the pleasure, and I'm finding it more and more, and I'm meeting more and more really cool people, even beyond me, even with us being, and I've mentioned this before, but I have a self-imposed continued isolation, because I really don't want to get this close to the finish line and get sick. It makes no sense for me to be on quarantine for almost a year and a half and then get, it's like being one in goal and spike the ball. And that makes absolutely no sense to me. And I've found that there are other podcasts, reading podcasts, apocalyptic podcasts, fictional podcasts, news podcasts, that probably do a much better job than I do as far as talking about things that I'm also interested in. And I just hate rehashing things, but there are things that I see on the news or I read in the newspaper that gags me. I found that this story actually dropped back in 2020, and it profiled a group in Memphis that has a huge impact and is doing so much for the LGBTQ community, just housing for transgender individuals. I said at the top of my show that I want to highlight things from within the state, because, you know, we do get a whole bunch of things wrong, but there's a whole bunch of things that we do right. And the organizer of my sister's house is doing it right. This was created and founded with a $400 donation that grew to way over $20,000 overnight and is way up into, like, almost, I believe she said on CBS News, she's up to almost $750,000. And yes, it went from a local story and got national coverage within the last several weeks on CBS This Morning. they were able to buy 30 acres of land, place in 20 tiny homes right off the Loosahatchee River over in Memphis. That's another thing about Memphis. Memphis is solely, the water from the city of Memphis is solely fed by the water table and the river. They are not dependent on any water from anybody else or any other state. It is a self-contained system. I mentioned that because I mentioned that river, but I also, there was another story that I had mentioned that it really kind of tripped me out about how self-sufficient Memphis is. But Kayla Gore, who herself, the founder of Sister's House, was mentioning, or she basically came up with this because she knows that indignities and aggressions against trans individuals happen when they are homeless. They are more highly likely to be murdered or beat up. And giving them a stable abode is one, and getting them off the streets is one way to ensure their safety. And that's everybody. If you have a safe and secure and clean place to live, you will survive. And this is a way for them to, home ownership is a way for them to do this as they continue their journey in life. Her and Yasmin Hunter have a great operation going on in Memphis. And if you want to navigate to their GoFundMe page, I'll actually have the link in my podcast notes, but it is www.gofundme.com/F/MSH Memphis. And you can actually continue to donate to their cause. They're going to need continuing donations for continued operations, and I'm going to donate too, because I think they're actually doing a very good thing. You talk about the return investment. You can't beat that. If you save one woman from ending her life just because of her sexual identity, a tiny house, a 250, 300 square foot house can do that. I'm with it. So there you go. So that is this week's highlight in Black Excellence. The Kayla Gore and Yasmin Hunter of the for operations for My Sister's House.
White churches, black churches, different people, same verses. It's kind of hard to fight with each other. Laying down in the ground, 600. At every show, I see my people. They ain't the same, but they're all equal. One love, one God, one family. You're missing every color.
That is Kane Brown, Worldwide Beautiful. He actually won Best Video of the Year at the CMAs this past week also. And it's from his mixtape, Volume 1. And why not anchor Black Excellence with another amazing country singer who's also African American. And he claims it, and it's wonderful. He was up for Album of the Year, but I don't think he got that. So, Kane Brown, Worldwide Beautiful, in celebration of Black Excellence. I hope you enjoy this little clip. So, in addition to finding and following up on stories that have to do with us, about us doing for our community,
I spoke about the transgender community savior in Memphis, Tennessee. And even though this group is not in Tennessee, I'm wondering, well, they're going to have a sponsor or a donation, someone that's going to donate their own funds, mainly mine, to the philanthropic endeavors of this group. As I read through the paper, I keep finding like some pretty cool things that I just wanted to talk about. And I'm glad that I have myself and my podcast as a way to actually highlight this group, because it's been known. I mean, it just feels like in our country that there is no one that we can trust. Can't trust the police, local and locals sometimes, and the federal government. You can't trust them, and definitely couldn't trust them with the fool that was in charge. And we're still seeing the shenanigans of the last administration. And right next to making everybody pay their fair share of child care and education, which the Republicans are saying hell no to, we got our people helping our people. This is an open letter that for the Black Girl Freedom Fund. Extraordinary times require extraordinary measures. Now is the time for the Black Girl Freedom Fund. 57 years ago, just over 2 weeks after the historic March on Washington for Black girls, Addie Mae Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley were murdered by a KKK member who bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Their tragic deaths further galvanized the civil rights movement, ultimately leading to the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It would take a bombing and the killing of these little girls in order for people to do right. Imagine that. It outlawed discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And it would take probably several more decades before this would have just been this hate crime spurred the Civil Rights Act. But this would not have necessarily become an elevated to a hate crime until the legislation was put into place several decades later, as I said. Despite this landmark legislation, it would take a half a century before Thomas Blanton Jr. would be found guilty for these girls and their families to have any semblance of justice. Decades later, millions of Black girls and young women are still being denied justice. In 2013 and 2014, both trials against the Detroit police officer who shot and killed 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones in her grandmother's home ended as mistrials. Not one single arrest has been made in the case of Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old African-American emergency room technician who was fatally shot 8 times by the Louisville police in her home shortly after midnight on March 13, 2020, because you had a Black attorney general, unlike the attorney general, the special prosecutor for the case in Minnesota, who the Black dude instructed the grand jury the only charges they could consider. It was like he basically he effectively glossed over the fact that they shot this woman dead in her bed. They were at the wrong house, and who they were looking for was actually already in custody. Just saying. And like Sarah Collins, the 5th little girl who survived the monstrous bombing in Alabama, many other Black girls are simply forgotten. But she's not all forgotten, because I actually purchased her book. It was just dropped last year. The 5th little girl. And we can't forget. We got to say their names, but because we can't forget the tragedy that constantly happens to us over and over again. At this very moment, Black Lives Matter has emerged as our nation's largest political movement, and racial justice is receiving unprecedented philanthropic support. And yet Black girls and young women still remain adultified, victimized by violence, and erased from the very social justice movement for which they continue to risk their own lives. We Black women and femmes activists, artists, educators, organizers, and philanthropists have come together at the historic time to call attention to the fact that Black girls in the United States are in crisis, from discrimination in education and healthcare to sexual assault and policing. The lives and livelihoods of Black girls and young women are notably absent in the public narrative. Policies and justice movements most crucial to addressing inequality and racial trauma. They face significant barriers to educational achievement, economic and political equity, and are recipients of deeply embedded racial and gender biases in media, public policy, research, and philanthropy. According to the Miss Foundation Landmark Study on Philanthropy, women and girls of color account for 0.5%, 0.5%, y'all, of $66.9 billion by foundations, totaling just $5.48 per woman and girl of color in the United States. This needs to end now. You damn Skippy. We believe that by investing $1 billion in Black girls and young women over the next decade, we can make the biggest change possible. We know that all social justice efforts benefit when we place value in Black girls and women's lives and leadership. Our collective futures depend on it. Black girls are more likely than girls of any other race to see themselves as leaders in their homes and communities. Despite underinvestment in their power as change makers, 48% of Black girls agree with the statement, "I am a leader." According to the Girls Leadership's Ready to Lead report, in practice, Black girls and young women continue to put themselves at risk on the front lines of racial and gender justice movements and devise strategies to organize across identities and communities to advance justice for us all. Eventually, Black girls become Black women, and Black girls' leadership become Black women's leadership. Black women are the most civically engaged racial group and power players shaping our politics and labor force. They are starting small businesses at a higher rate than any other racial group. And in 2018 midterm election cycle, there were a record number of Black women running for office. These gains have been made in spite of Black women leaders being grossly underfunded, under-resourced, and underestimated. The tools and tactics that have been justified structural violence against Black women and girls are being used to subjugate all of our communities. Black women's and girls' voices, visions, and experiences are essential and necessary for the liberation of all Black people. It is clear that with intention and investment, Black girls can thrive. Imagine what 2030 would look like if there is a significant investment made in the lives and livelihood of Black girls now, if that 48% know they are leaders become 100%. We call on you to robustly invest in Black girls and women's leadership, innovation, wellness, advocacy. This support is necessary for our collective freedom and to ensure that all Black lives matter now and tomorrow. $1 billion for Black girls is a 10-year philanthropic initiative designed to invest in the brain trust, innovation, health, safety, education, artistic visions, research, and joy of Black girls and their families. For far too long, Black girls have shaped our democratic process and cultural legacy without expectation of return. We invite you to commit to their leadership by investing in the $1 billion for Black girls today. Co-founders of the Freedom Fund, Monique Harris, Latosha Brown, Tarana Burke, Fatima Goss Graves, Joanne Smith, Sherazade Tillett, Teresa Younger, Salamisha Tillett, I'm sorry if I'd hacked up her name, just to name a few, and Sierra. Gabrielle Union is on this list. Beyonce, I don't see her name, but she always kind of contributes on the DL. And there's two things that came out of me just looking up what the Black Girl Freedom Fund was. And not only am I going to include this hashtag in my podcast notes for this week, I'm also just overwhelmed that we actually had to make a go of it on our own for people to listen to make. And we know we're worth investing in. And now we got other people backing up, putting their money where their mouth is. There was an episode on Grey's Anatomy, which I never really watched. But as a part of the effort, they partnered with Shondaland, who basically everything she touches is gold. And they had a special episode of Grey's Anatomy where they it was portrayed that two young girl, black girls were being kidnapped and human trafficking, which reflects a social problem that the fund actually wants to address. But this open letter, this whole mission of this project, is something that I can actually get behind. And my donation, I know, is tax deductible. And it's basically a big why not. You talk about you know, I'm actually typing this in now. It just makes sense. And, you know, like return on investment. And basically, I'm going to put my money on us every time. Something that is organized, that has widespread support, doesn't smell like a scam. This is not another fire festival debacle. This is me investing in the future, and also as I'm always looking at tax deductible, I can do this all day long. I don't mind doing this. The reason why I'm adding, I still support some of these political action committees for the Democratic Party, because I think there's a lot of work done, and you can't do. Y'all tripping. I don't got 25 G's to give to them, because that's going to go in my house. But I will donate what I actually can. But I can tell people about this. Make sure I donate as much as I possibly can. Because they actually, which is kind of cool, they allow you to basically invest monthly. So I'm actually cool with that. Until I have to change the address. Because as I said, I actually am planning on closing on my next house. You know, financial freedom and financial IQ is going to be key for me to be able to navigate the treacherous waters that is my finances. It wasn't so long where I was ducking billing calls as well as the car repo man, just in case I would be sitting in a window and potentially see my truck being towed away. Not too far away from those days, even in spite of my education and being a physician. Still doesn't mean I knew how to balance my money, but I don't think anybody else that worked as hard as I did, basically not having the finances to take care of themselves. And it's a bitch when you actually have to explain that to people, because it's the first thing they ask. Well, aren't you so and so? And I'm like, yeah, but what, shopping addiction, not so much the student loans, because I was smart enough to have. I was absolutely smart enough to have. Most of my school was absolutely paid for. But that, again, it does not mean that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everything after school and living my life after that, I was able to, I was absolutely able to keep up with bills and just to want to do things that other people did, being able to travel, being able to live and explore and all of those things that I never got to see as a kid or growing up and having to experience it. And now, being a part of this philanthropic process, this makes sense to me. And I'm okay with donating my money for something that is so much greater than myself. So I wanted to basically take the time to highlight this endeavor, because I'm not sure of any or too many endeavors at all similar to this. But this, it seems like a pretty sure bet. You know what I mean? So there you go. Let's see what some of their featured projects are. They arts and culture, financial inclusion, health, education. But this climate control is just right on time, because this is the last part of Earth Day. And this is like One Earth is a RPA sponsored project that focuses on creating bold and clear vision for the climate movement that connects together efforts of individuals and organizations implementing tangible solutions in their own communities with guidance from a coalition of science. That's actually pretty cool. There's a Shark Conservation Fund, Global Resilient Cities, the Earth Charter Fund, Oceans 5. A bunch of educational opportunities for racial justice and equity, spiritual education. We're doing it. Even with very little, we always seem to figure out how to do something with nothing. And that's how we always have to roll, because we can't, it's not guaranteed that anybody, there are organizations like this in one place that will allow us to do what or to be to participate. But I'm going to look into an investment initiative designed to provide early stage capital injections for fintech startups that design and produce financial inclusion solutions. So I think, you know, even with me, my whole goal would be to set up a fund, not so much a hedge fund, because I don't really know what that is, but something like an ETF that people also can invest in. Pretty safe, nice returns, made up of food producers, renewable energy, and the like, because I think that's, if you're, we're going to, when you go green, you make green. Maybe that's what I'll call it. When you go green, you make green. It's going to take research, but maybe that type of thing. This philanthropic organization will actually be able to supply. And Bill and Melinda Gates and J.P. Morgan Chase are, and they are in the network of investors, is a part of the Catalyst Fund, which I think is actually pretty awesome. So, you know, there's just so much that you can do and can be involved in. You just have to find your niche and try many things, but don't just sit back on your laurels and expect help to come, or you create your own interests and you can create what you would actually would like to do. If you want to be a strategic analyst or a strategic consultant, you may actually have to create your own LLC, because there's a lot of people that give a lot of lip work and want to portray that they're all about inclusion, but they're just about hitting some weird number, but they are not about letting your black ass up in there, unfortunately. But with infusions from companies like J.P. Morgan Chase and the Gates and this Catalyst Fund, maybe you can actually create your own roadway, like many people before you have done. They've fallen, they've gotten back up, and they keep building the road if there wasn't a road. And they knock down walls if they have to. These organizations seem like they're about making it a lot easier. So, big ups to the Black Girl Freedom Fund and all of the supporters. This is basically what it's all about, you know. Helping each other and helping our community grow.
Had a couple of shadow bars, a couple of tequila shots at the bar down the block earlier tonight. Some cover singers say the real Montaigne, you are the best thing.
That is Nicky Guyton and Jimmy Allen. And I think this single from his Betty James album won Best New Single of the Year again in the Country Music Awards. And he is, I don't know if he is as new to the national listening audience as far as country music goes, because I didn't get really into country music until, you know, the past couple weeks. However, I wanted to highlight, it was just so much music that I could have highlighted in this section in celebration of these great African-American artists. But there you go. Outside of Darius Rucker and Charlie Pride, this young man actually is making a splash in the CMAs, in their tradition, in his own tradition, because obviously he has his own sound as well as Nicky Guyton does. And again, this is Drunk and I Miss You from his Betty James album that you can actually listen to on my pod, my playlist, or as well as download the album in its entirety and listen to it. So, getting back to what Tennessee does well, we do barbecue well, I think. It's all about the smoke and dipping sauce. That Memphis smoke ain't no joke. Texas, y'all aight. Kansas, y'all barbecues aight. But I just like Memphis, good old Memphis barbecue. But with that said, I am going to just chat a little bit about, I think it's too soon for me to actually go out here and experience this, but there is the 2021 World Champion Barbecue Contest. I think they have limited tickets still for sale, and I'm going to double check the website right quick. It's like what I used to go to, the food and wine event down in South Beach, but this is right at Riverside Drive in Tennessee. They said tickets are very limited. Their gate times, it runs from the 12th on up through the 15th. I will actually be moving during that period of time. So I will not be able to make that finger licking good time. I'll just try to order in from Sugar's Barbecue and just pretend that I'm there. But that's neither here nor there. The other thing that we do really well, or had done really well, is this past week was a celebration of 10 years when the first customer car came off the assembly line at VW of Chattanooga. This, if I did this, did the calculations right, this one foreign company building their cars here in the United States did more for Hamilton County and definitely for Chattanooga on so many different levels. This place employs several hundred people. It pays well, and they make very good cars. When I first came here, evidently they had only been here for 2 or 3 years, but basically the higher up allowed people to basically upgrade their houses. There was not a whole bunch of inventory, and there still isn't a lot of inventory on the market for the type of houses that people that work at that plant actually can afford. So they, where I used to live on the north side on Franklin, they had been building and they had started rebuilding the area. Tennessee, during the 60s, like a lot of metropolitan cities, basically almost drifted off and fell into the Tennessee River. But they, with one fell swoop, were able to bring an influx of money to the county, and there was a demand for services and for homes. The homes that were once abandoned and were selling for $20,000 and $30,000, people were just paying double and triple that just for the lot. They were tearing down houses, and the repercussions of them tearing down the houses and putting up multi-level houses is still being felt today, even with the ordinances, because they're talking about a lot of these houses, they're putting them up so fast that they can't sustain a tornado. We had an outbreak of tornadoes last year that they're still recovering from. Water shed, landslides, all of those things are having them to rethink their building code. But that's what neither here nor that said. What came because of the result of that is when VW came to the area, bringing it with it banking jobs, bringing it with it other manufacturing jobs. We needed places for people to stay. And they started building. They built and wrote that the car, first car rolled off. In addition to that, the new IF4, which my car is somewhere in the United States or on that boat as it got released in the Suez Canal. The ID4, which is Volkswagen all electric SUV, and is slated for assembly in Chattanooga next year, that I pre-ordered last summer, that's supposed to arrive probably within the next 60 to 90 days. That car has been named the World Car of the Year. That car is going to be made, as I said, in Chattanooga starting next year. But in the meantime, I'm getting the first iteration of it in blue, I believe, and with some tricked out rims. And it's supposed to hit here, as I said, within the next couple of months. But it's still being made in a plant in Germany. But they have already hired up, expanded the plant, and it's supposed, the first one's supposed to roll off the assembly line, as I said, next year. And so that makes me also proud. Not only do I work for a company that's right here in Chattanooga that I can say I'm still very proud, even though they make my eyes hurt because I roll them so hard every day, I can still say I'm very proud to work for the company that I do work for, as well as being buying a car that the plant is right here locally too. You can't ask for much more of that. The Tennessee Tutoring Courses Corps is basically launching a program to address what they used to call summer slide, but we're going to have to call that a year slide. 2020 and everybody being remote, test scores and retention of learning is at an all-time low because of the pandemic. But this this program is accepting, the program runs for 8 weeks and it actually starts on June 7th. The application deadline is April 27th. You can actually navigate to the Tennessee Tutoring Court website, which again, I'll have the address, the website address in the notes for the podcast. And you can't talk about Tennessee if you don't talk about our whiskey. We like our food. We like our poke. We like our drinks. And no doubt that between Uncle Nearest being made in Lynchburg, Jack Daniels is also made locally with some other single barrel local shops all through the Tennessee Valley. But I mentioned that to say that the maker of Jim Beam and Maker's Mark, which is crafted in Kentucky, they are promising to reduce their greenhouse emissions and use and water usage by half by 2030. Very ambitious, but they want to basically cut to only a tenth of cut their emissions to a tenth of where they are today, which is really ambitious. And they are also committed to planting 500,000 trees annually also by 2030. They're not the only company that has promised to do that. There's another company that I can't remember right offhand that is also promising to replant the forest. And I think it is an energy company. I don't know if it's TVA or some other local or EPB, one of the other local energy providers. But I think that's pretty amazing. You know, I always complain about the stupidity of a lot of people, that what we call mouth breathers here in the South. But there are also groups of people and people that just are committed to doing the right thing. And for that, I give them the big ups. And this is where I'm going to leave y'all today. Things that are just weird. I didn't realize until this article actually came out in today's paper about 5 years since Prince's death. Basically, Paisley Park, his massive home and recording studio in Minnesota, has been turned into, has become a museum. And in celebration of his life and legacy, they will have a Paisley Park-shaped urn. On display in celebration of the anniversary of his death, which is 5 years this week. What I didn't need to know was from his uncle Pepe Willie, that's his name, y'all, Pepe Willie, who married one of his aunts. He was an early music mentor, and he still tears up. And this is what he basically tells the Associated Press. It was devastating when he heard about Prince's death. I'm standing in the living room with my underwear on, watching the TV, and I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't do anything. I was just so much in shock. It was unbelievable. Number one, you don't need to talk to Uncle Willie and where he was doing and what he wasn't wearing, because I didn't need to know. Don't need the visual in my mind of him standing in his tidy whities, staring at the TV at the time of Prince's death. I don't need that visual, Uncle Willie, but I appreciate the sentiment, but that was just a little bit TMI.
that is Wild Signal by John Williams from Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And what better way to introduce or the music lead in to this section of another chapters from my online sci-fi hopeful thriller listeners. I've changed the layout and integration of real life events, the COVID scourge, how it started, how it possibly started, and why we should not be so arrogant to think we're the only intelligent life form in this great universe. I think they already have been here or are here, and there could be some malevolent entities that want to take over. But for the most part, I think they're more benevolent than they are malevolent. Meaning, pull up a dictionary, look it up. Bad versus good, evil versus that really want to live in a symbiotic relationship with us instead of as conquerors. That's the whole premise of the book. Extraterrestrials are already here. They don't mean us any harm, and they're not as warped, and it could be visually pleasing and definitely more smarter than we are. So,
COVID, almost the final curtain for humanity. The scourge would bring a silence so complete before the intergalactic wailing. This virus was created as a weapon, the perfect diabolical biological agent. In the tradition of the Egyptian engineers who were sealed inside the pharaoh's tomb to keep the secrets of the building of the greatest marvels on earth, the inventors were to die as this weapon was unleashed on an unsuspecting world. The replacement's existence is not linear. They, like the one, exist outside of normal time and space. This plan to erase humans forever from existence had been at work since the first humanoid stood up from the mire of the molecular soup. They realized if they could have subjugated the Neanderthal, the power... of evolution had changed the trajectory of the power of the new race of beings. Higher brain functions, all adaptable. The implication of these initially powerless, arrogant, and weak, not knowing their purpose, not knowing they too have the power to evolve into something greater, to coexist with their environment. The replacements seek only to conquer and to rule. They can exist only with resources. For their advanced existence, they could not see past living in harmony with other beings. They only seek to subjugate and destroy. All for the expansion of the power realm in all quadrants. The subjugation of Earth and the eradication should be of the humans would be the greatest victory for the power realm, proving its power, but the one would ensure this would not happen. Then COVID hit, or did it? Before Sahara and Sahira Lundgren, just in case you don't know who they are, would start their desperate flight to Appalachia, and the medical doctor would become the town crier for a disease he did not understand, killing him before the implications to the world would be revealed. A Nazi-era scientific consortium had worked continuously since the 1940s. Stealing and weaponizing biodata. It was this consortium that had been feeding the data for this enhanced contagion to unsuspecting engineers worldwide for 10 years. Just such a scientist would use the data practicing editing in hopes to create a cure for cancer and other genetic diseases. His lab was using a form of COVID as a vector. They were editing and resequencing and studying the proteins. When he was notified by the provincial government of a visiting envoy from the U.S. headed by the daughter of the then U.S. president, he was excited to share his knowledge with the world. What he was not aware of, this was a reconnaissance mission to discover the advancements and stop them. The intent was always not to allow further evolution of the human race and use its own technology to control, eradicate any dissenters of the new order. It was key to know the technology, use it against humanity, and kill anyone that could possibly figure out a way to fight it. So when the pencil-thin blonde stepped out of the government vehicle, removing her mirrored, oversized sunglasses, she resembled an old Hollywood starlet. But what was disturbing was the lack of warmth and humanity in her crystal blue eyes and her unnatural, immobile face. The replaced interrogator reaches out her cold, dry hand, grasping the researcher, and speaks in her clear American voice. "It's a pleasure to meet you. I am excited to see all the wonderful work you have done." "Here to save the world. What a great day for science. What a great day for the world." There was applause, but something inside froze. He felt no gratitude from anyone in this party, but he would lead the group through the facility. The security cameras would be switched to a false feed over the researcher's lab. As they pass by the lead researcher's workstation, an aide stays behind and switches a glass plate with liquid contents with one of the other plates and changing the label. The team would continue the tour. A few more photo opportunities would ensue before the visitors would disappear and leave the compound. The interrogator would send the text, "Mission complete. Vector will be deployed before sundown." The researcher would return to his workstation because the work he did never Because of the work he did, he never double gloved, but when he dropped the plate containing the weaponized virus, ripping his glove and infecting him through a cut on his finger, he gets up. To wash his hand and regloving, but the virus particles had already made its way into his bloodstream. He would become symptomatic in 72 hours, but would go on to infect his wife, sons, twin sons, and his grandparent and their grandparents, his mother and father living in the multi-generational home in Wuhan. He would recover somewhat, but his family would become sicker. He wanted to surprise his wife with a traditional hairy crab meal, feeling bad that she had been so ill. The fish market in Wuhan had the pricey crabs at $400 USD per crab, but the delicacy still selling out within hours. Even though he felt ill and was coughing, with one sneeze, he would infect the patron behind him, who giving him an ancient curse in Mandarin, but she would become infected, and then infect her husband and only son, all dying, drowning in their own secretions. Then the fishmonger, who would be infected from the viral loaded sputum, who would then infect every other patron in his entire family, survival rate would be zero. The scientist would proudly bring the crabs home for his mother to prepare, but the crabs would sit in the cooler, spoiling. His mother by that time would be rushed to the local hospital, unable to breathe, followed by her husband of 40 years, each dying within hours, alone. Then, as he cradled his son, as he breathed his last breath, as the baby boy burned with fever, grasping for air, on a deeper level, his father knew he was the assassin, pulling the microbial bullet. He would collect samples from his son's bodies, his twin boys both expire, and then from his now comatose wife, returning to his lab, submitting the samples to mRNA rapid sequencing. With the exception of a few base pair changes, he identified the culprit, present in several million parts, startlingly identical to the virus he had worked on throughout his career, but with significant changes to the DNA architecture, enhancing it in many ways. He would continue his work, and his mind went back to that visit to his lab and how odd it was, and he remembered one of the visitors joining the rest of the group after a few minutes. Then he knew. They planted the contagion, hopeful it would kill him before he could figure it out. He knew he had to get the word out to the world if possible. Being the diligent scientist, he prepared a statement explaining his findings to his superiors and submitting his resignation with copies going to a classmate who was an ophthalmologist and his former research assistant, Huang, part of Afro-Druids, Hong Kong. He would return home, finding the cold corpse of his wife, blue from oxygen deprivation. He leaves a very short note in Mandarin. It's my fault. I'm sorry. He then pulls his wife's body into the bathroom, opens the arteries of his wrist, his life force leaving him. The authorities would find his and his wife's corpses with the rotting of the hairy crab as the hygiene squads were making their morbid sweeps, collecting such bodies. The scientist, racked with guilt that he had been as a vector to spread of a contagion, was too much to bear. The information was buried because no one would believe such treachery could be perpetuated, and everyone would blame the Chinese because of xenophobia and fear. So much time was wasted spending it on the cover-up and not discovering an antidote or a vaccine or reliable treatment, as the information was leaked with no plan for containment and treatment. The replacements were banking on the world shunning the mighty population. They knew what had come before and what humanity could become. They had to be silenced. The Huns, Tibetan, Buddhist monks all seemed spare the indignity of death given their seclusion in the mountains, inaccessible by government, literally dying in the streets. Within their sacred scrolls were the truth of the replacements. As the virus would rage in the Middle East, the hijab-shrouded women would be spared, given their isolation and religious facial coverings, but released as their men died from illness, an illness no one understood. Also, the last of the desert nomads, due to their isolation and facial shrouding from windstorms, more signs as the hieroglyphics on the pyramids also glowed, markings on Stonehenge. And as the stones glowed and began to pulse, Mayan and Incan ruins began to vibrate. The last of the last Coptic nunnery in Ethiopia, the one shimmering in blue light, would reveal itself to Reverend Mother as she was served last unction. She was dying. As the one inhabited her body, decimated and in pain by bone cancer. She sat up straight after being in a coma for days, her eyes open, glowing with the light of understanding, her voice taking on a quality of strength not heard ever in her life. She would roar, "We got it wrong." The message was, we hold the strength to save ourselves. Hell is believing and acting to separate us. No differences. We all deserve to exist. We have to spread the word, the message, or none of us will exist. Do this to save everyone. She turns, then glowing brighter and brighter, standing before the Coptic bishop, removing his hat, stepping back as it glows brighter and brighter, igniting, burning bright until it becomes black ash. He screams, "Satan." The Reverend Mother, "No, not Satan, just released. You won't exist if you don't tell the truth." He and his priest all back out of the room, evoking the sign of the cross and throwing holy water in their direction. The water taking on a golden hue, expanding and dissipating, showering everyone in a fantastic glow. As if scalded, the men flee. Not so surprisingly, none of the women flee. They stand boldly before the glowing, now former nun, with one of the local women frowning and saying, "So all this and suffering for naught?" The Reverend Mother takes her hand. "No, not for naught, my sister. But the suffering stops today. You will lead them. The truth of this moment, tell the world. This body is the messenger, not the message. Prepare them what is to come. It will be great. Now, this mouthpiece must rest." She floats back to her deathbed, lying down on her back, crossing her arms. She fixes the women with a penetrating glow. The women do not break the gaze, nods. As light of life leaves the former nun's eyes, she steps forward, closing the eyelids. The women begin to wail of warning of what was to come.
Black leather glove, no sequins. Buckles on the jacket, it's elite shit. Nike crossbody, got a piece in it. Gotta dance, but it's really on some street shit. I'ma show you how to get it. It go right foot up, left foot slide, left foot up.
Why not start out this part of the podcast with a bop? And that is Drake from his single Tootsie Slide, or which is above the same name. Every now and again, I believe, or I've been told, that Drake, he just recorded a song in his house with him just dancing and bopping around, and he just happened to share it with us. Well, why not? You know? At least the brother's keeping out of trouble, and I can actually testament to that, because there are a lot of stars that are wilding out. His house does look like a department store or some type of weird modern museum. But enjoy Tootsie Slide while you dance, cheer dance to this section of weird but true that I actually noticed in the paper this past week.
Stop. Got so many ops, I be mistaken ops for other ops. Got so many people that I love out of trouble spots. Other than the fact.
With another weird tidbit from the news and the wobble by VIC from the album The Beast. Last thing that I read that I had to mention is just weird. A woman and her daughter were driving down I-95 in Florida, and she gets clocked in the head by a flying turtle, y'all. She suffered a gash. They retrieved the blasted turtle and let him go in the wild with only a slight abrasion on his shell, and he wobbled back into the woods. I can't make this crap up, but I had to leave you with that weird but true thing. This actually has been a great and a wonderful podcast to actually produce this week. I'm trying to get better at just commenting and coming up with things as I continue to write and edit my sci-fi thriller, as well as pairing music to how I feel at the time. I want to make sure that the music actually is compatible with what I'm talking. Well, to some extent, because I find music to be also encouraging and influence me what mood and get me moving for the day. So let's wobble into the rest of our Sunday. I hope you will enjoy this podcast as much as I've enjoyed creating it. Like me on wherever you listen to the podcast. Download, share with friends. Just saying. Make them back it up. Make them back it up. Big girl. Make them back it up. Make them back it up. Back it up.